5%.
That's David Cook, an economist for the State of Oregon Employment Department. He says that for January, Oregon added about 1,000 new jobs.
For January, compared with December, we saw non-farm payroll employment up 1,100 jobs on a seasonally adjusted basis. Construction employment was up 1,700 jobs on a seasonally adjusted basis in January. And then leisure and hospitality was up 1,100 jobs, and that's mostly restaurants.
The category that didn't do so well was financial activity. Cook speculates that construction has been doing better due to the inherent nature of the industry.
Well, construction, it's somewhat of a rebound from the housing bust in 2009, where construction employment in Oregon was around 105,000 on a seasonally adjusted basis back in 2007, and then it dropped below 70,000 a couple years later. Construction employment has been close to 70,000 during 2010, 2011, and 2012, and it's only recently started to grow substantially, and even now it's only up to about 77,000 jobs on a seasonally adjusted basis. So we're still below where we were in the mid and late 90s in terms of total construction employment. So it's a very cyclical industry, and we had a very pronounced housing boom and bust, and the housing construction numbers have picked up considerably over the past year and a half or so, but they're still well below these peaks of the housing boom in 05, 06, and 07.
The report released this week also included annual numbers based on race and gender. For advocates of job equality, there is still a lot of work that remains to be done. Cook says that the numbers don't lie.
Men had an unemployment rate in Oregon of 8.4%, and women had 7.3%. So the unemployment rate for men was higher than women. And then the white unemployment rate, 7.8%. Black or African American was 17.6%. Hispanic or Latino, 11.1%. So all of these measures of unemployment did drop from 2012. And also the black or African American being 17.6% was considerably above the total unemployment rate 7.9%, and also the Hispanic or Latino rate of 11.1% was substantially above the total as well.
As for the unemployment rate, Cook says that it's hard to come to any real-world conclusions based on 1 month's change of 0.1%.
Anytime the rate moves by 1 or 2 tenths of a percentage point, we typically will say that the figure was essentially unchanged because the precision of the numbers for the unemployment rate is fairly low, and so it takes a movement of more than, say, 3 or 4 tenths of a percentage point to be a significant change.
And with an eye on the future, Cook says that we should expect around the same amount of growth in 2014.
So they're calling for continued expansion, close to the same rate that we've seen over the past year or so in Oregon's payroll employment and the economy overall. So we would expect to see growth at a rate of around 2 to 3% over the next year or so, similar to what we saw in 2013.
For KBOO News, this is Ryan Katz.
After 2.5 hours of public comment on Wednesday, Union County officials voted unanimously to tear down the building in La Grande, Oregon, that houses the only domestic violence services in all of Union County and outlying areas. This center is called Shelter from the Storm, and it serves a population of about 26,000 people. 700 clients relied on the services in the past year. The center served as a central hub for domestic violence survivors with a hotline, a food bank, childcare, counseling, and legal services. In 1998, Shelter from the Storm was built with money received from a community block grant. The county technically owns the land where the building sits. Also, there is a Justice Center campus along with a courthouse, police station, and other public offices. The proximity to the courthouse made it convenient for staff members to walk over with victims to obtain life-saving restraining orders. Shelter from the Storm received a $10,000 grant for a sexual assault forensic exam room, which had to be put on hold due to the imminent move. Supporters of the shelter say that the decision to tear down the building is a backroom deal by county officials to make room for a new $2 million courthouse in La Grande.
A bill that would penalize employers who lay off workers to avoid providing health insurance did not make it through the legislative session in Salem. Supporters say the bill is a way to meet the spirit of the health care reform law. But as the short legislative session wrapped up today, SB 1543 was one of many bills left behind. KBOO's Tim Nakayama has more in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
One casualty of the short Oregon legislative session is a bill that said an employer can't reduce a worker's hours on the job just to keep from having to provide the worker with health insurance. For the millions of people working not quite full-time, the news that their company could skirt the intent of the Affordable Care Act by cutting their weekly hours to 29 or less can be daunting. Senate Bill 1543 said if that happened and a worker complained, the employer would have to prove other reasons for the cutback. Oregon healthcare activist Rich Rhodes said it would have been an easy fix for a situation that's bound to happen.
This is partially in response to the threats that companies were going to do this. In some cases, they've tried to do it. This is just a very simple bill that says if you cut for that reason, it gives the employee a way to fight back and to get a redress on that issue.
From restaurant workers to adjunct college professors, nationally it's estimated that 6 million people are considered full-time employees, but work 30 to 35 hours a week. Delmar Stone with the National Association of Social Workers in Oregon says for these workers, additional cuts in hours would be a financial strain as well as a health insurance issue.
You know, it's difficult to even get health insurance, as most of us know. So now they have that added challenge and losing hours. That is the biggest concern, actually.
It would have been up to the Bureau of Labor and Industries to enforce the bill had it become law. It had a hearing last month, but didn't make it out of a Senate committee. Supporters say they will introduce the idea again in the next session. This is Tim Nakayama,
Diablo,
with KBOO News.
The Oregon legislature is set to pass a bill today that would give OHSU $200 million in its bid to create a world-renowned cancer research center. Many are questioning why OHSU is looking to the state for money when it has historically received donations from private donors. KBOO reporter Keegan Heron spoke with David Roth of Tax Fairness Oregon for more.
What was the impetus for OHSU requesting $200 million from the Oregon legislature?
It was the commitment from Phil Knight and his family to donate $500 million, half a billion, to the Knight Cancer Institute at OHSU if OHSU was able to match it with $500 million from other sources.
And why is OHSU looking to Oregon taxpayers rather than private donors to fund their expansion?
Because if they included a state loan, it would make it a lot easier for them to reach the target. The Knight proposal gave them a deadline of 2 years, and that would have required a good deal of work to raise $500 million from private donors, foundations, and so on. So they decided that it was safer. They were more likely to actually bring home the bacon if they took advantage of the state's bonding capacity.
Where will this money be taken from?
It would come from the general fund.
Does that mean that schools across the state would have less money?
The estimated cost of the loan, which the state would have to pay back, both in principal and interest, is about $400 million. That's an estimate from the Treasury Department itself. The state has a very ambitious growth plan for education, too, and that's the 40-40-20 plan that commits the state to 40% of Oregon children complete their education with a bachelor's degree, and 40% complete their education with a AA degree, community college, and 20% complete a valid high school diploma. That's a huge plan, and it depends upon one thing in particular, early childhood education, something that Oregon has not funded very well at all. At this point, state of Oregon and the feds together are funding about 14% of children, that's kids who are over three, who aren't yet eligible for first grade. So it would include preschool and what's called kindergarten. Only 14%. What $34 million a biennium would do over 20 years, this is paying off the loan and paying off the interest by taking money out of the general fund from taxes. What it would have done would be to pay for 30,000 Oregon children could get 1 year of preschool. And that, taken where we are right now, would be a significant step towards something like what the 40-40-20 plan requires.
I've been speaking with David Roth of Tax Fairness Oregon. This is Keegan Herron with KBOO News.
Tomorrow in Pioneer Square at noon, hundreds of people are expected to gather for a people's hearing against coal exports. The event is organized by Columbia Riverkeepers, the Sierra Club, and student groups from local universities. Testimony will be taken preparatory to asking Governor Kitzhaber to make a decision to stop any future coal export projects from going through Oregon. This rally comes right before a decision by the state of Oregon on whether to approve the permit for the Morrow Pacific Export Facility. The proposed coal export terminal would be the first of its kind on the Columbia River. The rally will be from 12 to 2 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square. Besides the rally, participants will create a human billboard with a message for the governor.
A state-administered program to help Oregonians struggling with underwater mortgages and high interest rate loans is being expanded across the state. The Rebuilding American Homeownership Assistance Pilot Program is now available for residents of Marion and Polk counties. Qualified homeowners, those having underwater mortgages, can refinance through the program. A spokesperson for the program said the average participant so far has saved over $250 a month and had an average interest rate reduction of about 2%. Statistics show that 26% of homeowners in Marion County are underwater on their mortgages. That means that homeowners owe more on their mortgage than their property is actually worth. In Polk County, about 23% of homeowners have underwater mortgages. To qualify, homeowners need to be current on their mortgage payments and be ineligible for the federal assistance program because their loans are not owned or insured by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. Homeowners can go to OregonHomeownerHelp.org to submit an online application.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin after this newscast, followed by Bird and Roses at 6. Tonight, poet, musician, and activist Joy Harjo will speak about overcoming fear. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. This weekend's weather will include lovely spring rain on Saturday and Sunday, with highs in the low 60s and lows in the low 40s. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 6:38 a.m. and sunset tomorrow at 6:06 p.m. The moon is a waxing crescent. On today's date in 1876, Alexander Graham Bell was issued a patent for the telephone. In 1944, American singer-songwriter Thomas Van Sant was born. And on this date in 2006, the Malian guitarist Ali Farka Touré died. Today's quote of the day: Isaac Newton speaking on his scientific discoveries. I was like a boy playing on the seashore, amusing myself now and then finding a smoother pebble or prettier shell, while the great ocean of truth lay all undiscovered before me. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 28 counts per minute in North Portland, Moosepile Butte measures 27 counts per minute. In Vancouver, Washington, the radiation count is 23 CPM. Spokane has 51 CPM. Seattle has 28 CPM. And Vancouver, BC has a radiation count of 36 counts per minute. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information on radiation counts, including the meaning of counts per minute, can be found at radcast.org.
It's 5:20 p.m. Time for the Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
Okay, climate change deniers, you've gone too far. You've gone from just being annoying know-nothings to now posing a serious threat to an essential good that embodies humankind's finest collaboration with nature, beer. It's one thing for the science denial cult to stand in the way of doing something about melting ice caps in the Arctic, but it's another thing altogether for them to mess with beer. This makes it personal. While the deniers keep doing their denial dance, California is drying up. The higher temperatures caused by climate change has produced an ongoing drought that has, among other bad things, caused a precipitous drop in the water level of Lake Mendocino, which could come close to being a dry lake bed this summer. What has that got to do with beer? Glad you ask. Mendocino feeds the Russian River, which flows by the town of Petaluma, home of Lagunitas Brewing Company, which makes very fine beers. A key ingredient in the Lagunitas brew is the excellent water the company draws from the Russian River, which presently is in danger of becoming a trickle. Can't Lagunitas and other breweries along the river just switch to groundwater? No. The head beermaster at Lagunitas notes that heavy minerals in that water would cause it to fizz in the brewing process. Plus, there are concentrations of nitrates, iron, and manganese in the area's groundwater, creating issues of odor, taste, and other unpleasantries that do not add up to good beer. This is Jim Hightower saying, what the Lagunitas experience is teaching us once again is that the nature of nature is that all things are linked together, despite the fantasies of industry shills who insist that their contaminants have no dire consequences. Mess with the global climate, and you mess with Lake Mendocino, which messes with the Russian River, which messes with the beer. And now, you're messing with me and millions of other beer drinkers. Like I said, it's personal.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
A federal judge ruled today that civilian-operated drones flying under 400 feet cannot be stopped by the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA. Currently, there are no laws on the books for low-flying drones. The FAA has so far been unsuccessful at regulating farmers, photographers, and business people who have started to use drones. Some civilian uses of drones include tracking wildlife, fish, and endangered species, and looking at farm crops from above to determine their health. But many Americans are concerned about weaponized drones and the potential use for mass surveillance by drones. The FAA says that policies on domestic drone use will be in place by the end of the year. Any appeals will go to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia.
The Kansas Supreme Court ruled today that the state's minimal spending on education is unconstitutional. Major tax cuts in 2012 and 2013 have left school districts across the state with overcrowded classrooms, fewer staff, and no after-school care. The court ruled that the state had broken a promise it had made to citizens in 2006 that specified a certain level of funding for public schools. The decision will now return to the district court to determine how much money should be given to the failing school system and how that money should be allocated. Kansas ranks 13th in the country in high school graduation rates. Oregon comes in at 46th. Kansas also has a significantly lower student-to-teacher ratio than Oregon. The Kansas court decision is making news across the country primarily because it calls into question what are acceptable standards for public education. The ruling also brings up the issue of the level of public responsibility for ensuring a decent education for its students.
A study out of Oregon State University found that girls who play with Barbie dolls are less likely to consider that certain careers are possible for them. Girls between the ages of 4 and 10 who participated in the study were given either a Barbie doll or a Mrs. Potato Head to play with. After playing for a while, the girls were then asked several questions about future occupations. They were given a list of 10 occupations and asked if they thought they could do each of the jobs. The girls who played with the Barbies in the research study selected fewer jobs for themselves. They also answered negatively to the question of whether they could do any of the same jobs that boys could do. The girls who played with the Mrs. Potato Head doll answered that they could do any of the jobs that the boys could do. Although the study was not comprehensive, the head researcher said that more studies are needed to determine a larger pattern.
Tomorrow marks International Women's Day, which is an annual event to bring attention to issues affecting women worldwide. For more, we go to KBOO's Susan Cecil.
International Women's Day has its origins in socialist gatherings of women and strikes of women garment factory workers more than 100 years ago. James Andrews is a professor of Russian and Soviet history. He describes the 1917 women's strike that led to the designation of March 8th as International Women's Day.
These strikes occurred over a three-day period. The Tsar resigned that month, abdicated the throne in February, old calendar, March of 1917. And then there's a whole nother history of what happened to International Women's Day during the Soviet period under Lenin. There was a very famous Bolshevik, social democratic feminist writer by the name of Alexandra Kollontai, who was one of Lenin's associates. And she particularly urged Lenin to make International Women's Day a national Soviet holiday. And they did under Lenin before his death in 1924. However, they didn't make it a non-working holiday. They only celebrated it. It wasn't until later in the post-World War II era that that occurred. So those revolutionary days that brought down the Tsar, right, are around March 8th to 11th. Later, Lenin and Kollontai used March 8th in the 1920s as the official holiday date. And we're pretty sure that the Russians borrowed International Women's Day from European movements, but in Copenhagen, they didn't celebrate it until March 18th. So although I'm not 100% positive about this, after the 1920s in Russia, March 8th became the official day. And then this was replicated in Communist China after 1949 and in other socialist countries as well, globally.
The issue of sweatshop labor has not been resolved. And even today, women and girls work in difficult conditions in sweatshops around the world. Laura Crossett with Students Against Sweatshops helped bring about changes to university licensing policies around the year 2000.
There were three prongs to the requests that students were making of our administration. One was to require that brands who license their products to use the university name, university logo, begin publicly disclosing where they're made. I mean, if you can imagine, that was the very fundamental first demand, because there was no requirement before that we even had got to find out where the things were being made. So there was first access to information. Second prong of it was that the university adopted a code of conduct, which laid out some very basic standards on what do we expect, health and safety, no discrimination. And then the third prong was the Worker Rights Consortium. So the Worker Rights Consortium is an independent organization that monitors factory conditions, and it's particularly focused on collegiate apparel. So it was founded by student activists, essentially, who convinced enough universities around the country to all contribute a small percentage of their licensing fees toward the goal of creating a better monitoring system.
Although a number of victories have been won, the struggle to end sweatshop labor is ongoing. International Women's Day events will take place in cities around the world tomorrow And KABU will have a special day of programming beginning at midnight tonight. For KABU News, I'm Susan Cecil.
Today, Russia's largest gas company, Gazprom, announced that the Ukrainian government had missed its deadline to pay for gas its citizens received in February. Gazprom went on to say that if Ukraine did not make the $440 million payment, it would cut off all of its gas exports to Ukraine. Fuel from Gazprom accounts for about half the gas used in Ukraine. Ukraine is also the intermediary between Russian gas companies and European consumers. EU officials have pledged to reverse the gas flow from Europe back to Ukraine if Russia cuts off supplies. The extra gas would come from holding tanks in Germany and Hungary, but EU officials admit it would be a short-term solution. The issue has also highlighted discussions in the federal government that the U.S. could become a gas exporter within a few years, thus negating Russia's influence on world reserves. The boom in recent years of U.S. gas is due to fracking operations that have sprung up across the country. The Department of Energy has already approved 6 liquefied natural gas terminals to be built on the Gulf Coast in Texas and Louisiana, and applications are pending for 24 more.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, the U.S. military offered its condolences after a drone strike Wednesday night mistakenly killed 5 Afghan soldiers and injured at least 7. The pre-dawn strike in eastern Afghanistan's Logar province was described by U.S. military officials as an unfortunate incident. The so-called friendly fire incident comes as U.S. and Afghan officials continue to clash over an agreement that would keep American troops in the country beyond the end of the year. You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Please call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ryan Katz, Tim Nakayama, Susan Cecil, and Kristen Yount. The producer is Keegan Heron, and our engineer is Ian Gadberry. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. Podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KABU News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are some phone numbers, so grab a pen and get something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Kristen Yount.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU, Swingin' Country at 6, followed by Bluegrass at 9. And on Monday morning at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, Celeste Carey and Cecil Prescott speak with Clive Thompson, author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour, a program of social and political commentary from a socialist feminist point of view. At 10:15, Barbara Bernstein hosts Locus Focus, a weekly interview show about our place on the planet. At 11 on Health Watch, Dr. David Naiman interviews allergy specialist Dr. Susan Bennett about the 7-day allergy makeover. And at 11:30 on Health and Healthcare Forum, Roberta Hall speaks with Oregon State Representatives Mitch Greenlich and Jim Thompson about the Basic Health Program. It would provide affordable health insurance for some people currently not covered. Thank you, KABU members, for your great support. If you're not yet a KABU member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Now stay tuned for Bread and Roses, followed by Counterspin. Tonight on Bread and Roses, poet, musician, and activist Joy Harjo will speak about overcoming fear. Have a great weekend. Good night, Kristen.
Good night, Liam.
KBOO Community Radio and Oaks Park Roller Rink proudly present Bounce, Roll, Skate, Tuesday, March 11th from 7 to 9 p.m. This is a family-friendly event for all ages. We'll be broadcasting a two-hour funk and disco mashup special live on 90.7 FM KBOO, and you can be a part of it. Feel free to dress up in your favorite 70s outfits, wigs, and costumes. That's Bounce, Roll, Skate, March 11th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Oaks Park Roller Rink. Call 503-231-8032 for more details, or go to kboo.fm/bounce-roll-skate.
Tune in to Plugged In every first and third Fridays from 10 p.m. to midnight with host DJ Tronic. Tronic does a live mix in the studio featuring the latest in house, techno, tech house, breaks, dubstep, and more. Tronic also has guest DJs in the studio and often talks about upcoming parties, club nights, and more. That's Plugged In every first and third Fridays at 10 p.m. only on KBOO Portland.